Side 2. Eon by Greg Bear. Continuing on page 42. If you like to exercise, we have a running path around the inner perimeter of the compound with an extension that takes you to the second compound. There's a gym pit not far from here. I recommend pretty strenuous exercise whenever possible. The low G is a bit easy on us. I tend to get flabby if I don't maintain. An exercise will acclimate you more quickly to the air pressure. I think the low G is pleasant, she said as they walked to the front of a wide plastic sheet Quonset hut. Buoyant. Inside the hut were two vehicles resembling large snow cats, mounted on six rubber-tired band steel spoke wheels instead of treads. Patricia bent down to look beneath, then straightened. Very rugged, she said. Our trucks. Easy to drive. You'll learn soon. But today you're just going along for the ride. Keep your eyes peeled. He unlocked a door and helped her up the high step into the shotgun seat. He paused before closing the door. I'm sorry I came down on you so hard. I'm sure you understand how important you could be here, and...
I don't understand, Patricia said. I haven't the faintest idea what use I'll be.
Lanier nodded and smiled.
But you were right anyway. If I'm so important, then I need to keep my nose to the grindstone.
Looks like the stoned work ethic will come natural to you, Lanier said. He climbed into the driver's seat and reached into his pocket, pulling out a slate. He offered it to her. Slipped my mind. You'll probably want to make notes at some point or other. Government issue. He switched on the electric motor and drove the truck out of the shed. We're going into the second chamber now, into the first city. We'll spend a few hours there, then take you on the 30th Century Limited.
One of the trains?
He nodded. We'll skip the third chamber today. Too much too soon. It could overload you. We'll stop at the fourth chamber security compound for a break and lunch, and then go right through to the sixth chamber. The truck approached a chain-link fence, stretching for several kilometers east and west.
Would it be premature to ask questions now?
We have to start somewhere, Lanier said.
That's real dirt outside. You could grow things in it.
It's moderately fertile, Lanier said. We have several farming projects underway, mostly in the fourth chamber. Most of the dirt is straight carbonaceous asteroid material with supplements.
Hmm.
She turned to survey the scrub and the low plume of dust behind them.
Is the stone still powered up? I mean, can it leave?
It's still powered up, Lanier said. We don't know whether it can leave or not.
I was wondering if we could be trapped inside, if it decided to leave. Then we would need to farm, wouldn't we?
That's not why we're farming, Lanier said. She waited for him to elaborate, but he stared straight ahead, slowing the truck as they approached the gate in the wire fence. The motors are very old. Some of the engineers think they're worn out, he said, as if he had half listened to her and half followed his own chain of thought. He removed an electronic key from his pocket, dialed a number, and opened the gate with a radio signal. We don't understand the drive yet. The motor's last effective act was to slow the stone down for insertion into the present orbit. They used chunks of mass removed by robots from the outside of the stone, mostly in the deep bands. Mass drivers lobbed the chunks towards a point just above the northern crater. That end is sealed off. You will soon discover a second reason why. What happened to the chunks at that point, we don't know. The documentation is difficult.
I should imagine.
The truck hummed through the gate and across a track marked by tire ruts and an absence of scrub.
All that chain link, Patricia said. Once you pre-screened everyone coming up here, you'd think that would be enough security. Must have cost a lot to have all that stuff shipped up here. Could have shipped up science instead.
The chain link wasn't shipped here. We found it.
Chain link fence?
And figurines, Lanier said.
What are you talking about?
Humans built the stone, Patricia. People from Earth. She stared at him, then tried to grin. Built it 1,200 years ago. At least it's about 1,200 years old.
Oh, she said, pull the other one.
No, I'm serious.
I don't expect to be made fun of, she said quietly, straightening in her seat.
I'm not making fun. Do you think we'd ship 8 or 9 kilometers of chain link?
I'll believe that before I believe Charlemagne or whoever had the stone made to order.
I didn't say it came from our past. Before this goes any farther, please, Patricia, be patient. Wait and see. She nodded, but inside she was furious. This was some sort of initiation. Take the young woman out on a ride, terrorize her, stick her hand into a spaghetti worm mystery, bring her back and have a good laugh. She's now a true stoner. Great. She had never stood for that sort of treatment, even as a 13-year-old whiz kid at UCLA. Look at the scrub, Lanier said. It's grass. We didn't bring it with us.
It looks like grass, she acknowledged.
The ride across the valley took 30 minutes. They approached the slate-gray cap. A silvery metal arch stood before the entrance to the tunnel, which was about 20 meters wide. A ramp rose from the dirt to the entrance. Lanier accelerated up the ramp.
How is the air maintained? She asked.
The silence made her uncomfortable. Lanier switched the truck lights on. The middle three chambers have large ponds buried beneath them. The ponds are shallow and filled with several varieties of duckweed, water hyacinth, and algae, plus some other plants we're still identifying. The biggest pond is shaped like a donut and circles the fourth chamber. There are ventilation ducts in the caps at about 3 kilometers. You can see them with binoculars if you have sharp enough eyes, and the stone is honeycombed with other shafts and ducts. Patricia nodded, avoiding his eyes. She's going to be stoned soon, Lanier thought. Resentment was the first sign. Resentment and disbelief were much easier than acceptance, and the most careful introductions to the stone didn't prevent the cycle. Here, everyone came from Missouri. Everyone had to be shown first. All other learning and refinement came later. 6 minutes after entering the tunnel, they came to a heavy chain-link hurricane fence completely covering the tunnel mouth. Lanier opened another gate with his key, and they emerged in the second chamber. The ramp leading down from the tunnel had been fortified on each side with masonry walls. More fence had been strung between the walls, and a guardhouse stood to one side of the next gate. 3 Marines in black jumpsuits came to attention by the guardhouse as the truck rolled toward them, its tires grumbling on the ramp paving. Lanier braked the vehicle and shut it off, then swung down from his seat. Patricia remained where she was, staring at the vista before her. Beyond the ramp was a 2-kilometer-deep shelf of parkland, irregularly spotted by copses of trees and numerous broad, flat, white concrete structures resembling thick building foundations. Beyond the parkland, a narrow lake or river about 1 kilometer across ran east and west completely around the chamber. A suspension bridge with tall, slender, curved towers crossed the water, set between massive concrete anchors. The bridge pointed toward a city. It could have been Los Angeles on a very clear day, or any other modern terrestrial city, except for the surreal exaggeration. It was bigger, more ambitious and ordered, more architecturally mature, and scattered throughout the city, like bumpers on a pinball board, were the biggest structures she had ever seen in her life, easily 4 kilometers tall. They resembled giant chandeliers made of concrete, glass, and shining steel. Each facet of the nearest chandelier structure was as large as entire buildings in between. The chandelier resemblance increased as she looked up and saw them suspended from the chamber floor overhead. Across the 2 layers of atmosphere, 50 kilometers away, the city became beautifully unreal, like a model behind dusty glass in a museum. Her eyes swept to either side, head swinging as if she were watching a slow tennis match between progressively taller players. "Good morning, Mr. Lanier," said the senior officer, approaching to inspect his badge. "She's new?" Lanier nodded. "Patricia Vasquez, unlimited access." "Yes, sir. General Gerhardt passed the word yesterday to expect you." "Any activity?" Lanier asked. "Mitchell's survey squad is going through the K Mega now, at 30 degrees and 6 clicks. Lanier leaned back into the cab. "The Megas are the big buildings," he explained. She shielded her eyes against the plasma tube, trying to see the opposite side of the chamber more clearly. She could make out parks and small lakes, systems of streets, laid out in alternating concentric circles and square blocks. She was as far from the opposite wall as Long Beach was from Los Angeles. Despite its scale, the city was definitely human-built.
Lanier stepped up on the running board and asked if she would like to stretch her legs before they continued.
What do you call it? Patricia asked.
Its name is Alexandria.
You named it?
Lanier shook his head. No.
We're going all the way to the seventh chamber today, she asked.
If you're up to it.
How long do we stay here?
A few hours at most. I want you to get a look at the library before we continue.
A library?
Indeed, Lanier replied. One of the highlights. She settled back in her seat, eyes wide.
Is the city deserted?
Most of us think it is. We've had scattered reports, but I put it up to nerves. Boojums, the security team calls them. Ghosts. We've never found a live stoner.
You found dead ones?
Quite a number. There are mausoleums in this chamber and in the fourth chamber. The main cemetery in Alexandria is at 2 6 degrees and 10 kilometers. Do you understand the coordinate system?
I think so, Patricia said. Measure from the axis for angle, then distance from the cap. But what's zero, and which cap?
This is the zero bridge, and we measure from the south cap.
This isn't an initiation, then. You weren't telling me a story. Humans built the stone.
They did, Lanier said.
Where did they go?
Lanier smiled and waggled a finger.
I know, Patricia said, sighing. Wait and see for myself.
She stepped down from the truck and stretched, then rubbed her eyes.
I'm impressed.
The first time I saw Alexandria, I felt kind of at home, Lanier said. I was raised in New York, moved to L.A. when I was 15, lived in big cities all my life, practically. But this really impressed me, even so. We could move 20 million people into just this chamber and still not be crowded.
Is that why the stone is important, as real estate?
No, Lanier said. We don't plan on selling condos. We have 15 archaeologists on the team, and they'd kill anyone who even suggested it. They hold briefings every few days. I'm sure you'll attend several soon. They're working around the clock, and have been since we brought them up here 3 years ago. They haven't let us touch anything since that time, except when one of the security team commanders or myself has overruled them, and even then we needed damned good excuses. Patricia nodded to the three guards, who returned the greeting cordially, one tipping the visor on his cap. A radio in the guardhouse beeped and crackled. The senior officer answered. Patricia couldn't catch the guttural message, but the guard replied in what sounded like Russian.
I could have sworn they were all clean-cut American soldiers, Patricia said.
They are. There are Russians working with Hua Ling in the southern cap borehole.
The Marines speak Russian?
This one does, obviously. And 3 or 4 other languages. Cream of the crop.
Is there anybody up here who isn't brilliant?
No common grunts, if that's what you mean. We can't afford them. Everyone has to do double and triple duty. He sat in the driver's seat again. When you're ready, we'll cross the bridge and drive to the library.
Any time, Patricia said, resuming her seat.
Lanier advanced the tractor, and the gates swung wide for them, then closed after. They crossed the 4-lane bridge, tires chattering and whanging on the asphalt. Patricia reached into her pants pocket to pull out the slate. Using its 10-key shorthand board, she typed,
"Weather, or rather the absence of it. Sky is quite clear. Perspective, really startling. Land appears flat nearby, then just above the horizon, looking north, seems to curve, the curve getting more radical, up the side of the valley. The chamber overhead has lots of detail, visible through slight haze."
She played back what she had keyed in, hunting for errors. She had learned to type on a slate in high school, but that had been many years ago, and she preferred writing by hand. Paper, however, was obviously an expensive commodity on the stone, to be used sparingly. She continued to type as they passed down a broad thoroughfare. A street about 50 meters wide, divided down the middle by what might have been grass at one time, and trees. 2 lanes each side. None of the plants look healthy. Gardening systems deteriorating. Not working at all. Shop windows on street level, nearly all broken. Lobbies of businesses, agencies, open to the air. 1 window, humanoid mannequin, long-necked, poised but nude. She spotted a sign above what might have once been a jewelry store. "Kazars," she read. Latin alphabet. And on the other side of the sign, as they moved on, she saw that the same name had been spelled out in Cyrillic. Some shops had Oriental ideograms, Chinese and Japanese. Others were in Laotian and the modified Vietnamese Roman alphabet. "Lord," she breathed, "I could be back in L.A." There was something peculiar about the shops, the designs, even a few window displays. She squinted, trying to resolve the discrepancies. "Wait a minute," she said. Lanier slowed the truck. "This is all supposed to be quaint, isn't it? I mean, like back home, where we have shopping malls built to make us think we're in old England. This is supposed to be old-fashioned."
"As good an observation as any I've heard," Lanier said, shrugging. "I've never really paid this area much attention."
"Gary, I'm very confused. If the stone was built 1,000 years ago, how does all this fit in?"
Lanier swung around a gentle curve and brought the truck to a stop in the middle of the street. He pointed to a large, umber-toned building on the northern edge of the green space. "That's one of the libraries. One of two we're investigating now. All the others are closed off." Patricia clutched her lower lip between her teeth.
"Should I be nervous?" she asked.
"Probably. I would be."
"I mean, it's as if..."
She shook her head.
"Why should I go in there? I'm a mathematician. I'm not an engineer or a historian."
"Believe me, nobody enters the libraries on whim. You're uniquely qualified. You've been working in an area with no practical value until now."
"I'm going to stop asking questions," Patricia said, sighing. "I don't even know the right questions to ask."
Electronic sensors had been placed around the building. Chain-link fences topped by wicked-looking razor-wire curls enforced the gentle suggestions of sensors and cameras. 4 guards stood before the entrance carrying apples, anti-personnel lasers, and looking very serious. As Lanier and Vasquez approached, an amplified voice boomed out, "Mr. Lanier, stop and allow scan. Who's that with you?"
"Patricia Vasquez," he said. "Index under science team. Reference memo from General Gerhardt."
"Yes, sir. Advance and present ID.
They left the truck and walked to the gate. "We brought the razor wire and sensors up from Earth 2 years ago, Lanier told her, "when we began to realize what we had in there." They presented their IDs and laid their hands on a plate carried by a woman in black and gray. After being cleared, they entered the enclosure. The ground floor windows had been broken here as well. No signs or maps were evident within, but it had the definite feel of a library, though once again it seemed artificially quaint. The interior was dark and deserted. "The outside guards can't enter the library, only special security, black and gray uniforms. There's one person on duty inside at all times, with a video monitor, the voice we heard."
"Very fancy," Patricia said.
"Necessary." A strip of fluorescent lighting hanging from the ceiling on a bolted track flashed on. More strips glowed in sequence, making a path of light across the ground floor and up a flight of steps near the center of the building. "We have portable generators at 4 locations in Alexandria," Lanier said as they walked down the path. The floor was bare and dusty, with a few well-cleared tracks in the dust. "Most of the city's power nets aren't functioning. We haven't tracked down the power supplies yet, but they're probably not discrete plants. The stone itself seems to carry a reserve of power with concentrations in supercooled batteries." Patricia's brow wrinkled.
"Batteries?
Like the 100-meter cells in Arizona and the Greater African Conservatory."
"Oh."
She wasn't much on practical physics, but she didn't want Lanier to know that. "The electrical system is pretty conventional otherwise. Control and information channels are optical, more so than back on Earth. The buildings are dark because most of the circuit breakers, or whatever served that function, have been tripped, and nobody's going to reset them until we know more about fire hazards."
"Why are the windows broken?" Patricia asked as they continued climbing.
"Glass gets brittle with age, slumps. Pressure surges in the atmosphere crack the windows."
"Weather?"
"Of a sort. There are high and low pressure systems in the chambers, updrafts in Coriolis, downdrafts near the caps, even storms. Snow in some of the chambers, infrequently. Most of it seems controlled, but we don't know whether the controls are built in, static, or whether machines are still hard at work someplace. In the shadowy halls beyond the light strips on the second floor, she saw man-sized metallic cylinders arranged in rows, marching off into obscurity. "We've been pulling data out of these storage banks for a year," Lanier said. "The programming languages weren't familiar to us, so we've only had success producing readable copy and useful images for about 6 months. As it turns out, the library in the next chamber is even larger, so we're concentrating on it now. But I still prefer this. There's an extensive hard copy center on the fourth floor. That's where I did my early research, and where you'll be doing some of yours."
"I feel like I'm on a Mary Celeste."
"The comparison's been made," Lanier said. "At any rate, here or anywhere else, the rule is don't disturb anything you can't put back exactly the way it was. The archaeologists are just finishing their gross surveys, and they're still touchy. We have to break the rule now and then, repairing necessary equipment, tinkering with the computers, but no excess meddling is allowed. If the stone is a Mary Celeste, we can't afford not to know why." On the fourth floor, they entered a large room filled with reading cubicles, each with a viewer and a flat gray panel mounted in a small desk. One of the desks had been equipped with a recently imported tensor lamp connected to the new power supply. Lanier pulled out a chair for her. She sat. "I'll be back in a moment," he said. He walked to the opposite side of the room, passed through a door, and left her alone. She fingered the viewer on the desk. Was it for video? Microfilm? She couldn't tell. The screen was flat and black as ebony, no more than a quarter of an inch thick. There was something unusual about the chair. A small cylinder was mounted horizontally in the middle of the seat, fitting with some discomfort between her buttocks. There might have been cushions at one time covering the cylinder, or perhaps the chair created its own cushion when powered up. Patricia glanced nervously at the rows of empty cubicles, trying to imagine those who had last used them. When Lanier returned, she was very glad to see him. Her hands were trembling. "Spooky," she said, smiling weakly. He held out a small book bound in milky plastic. She thumbed through the pages. The paper was thin and tough. The language was English, though the typeface was unusual. Too many serifs. She opened to the title page. "Tom Sawyer," she read, "by Samuel Langhorne Clemens, Mark Twain." The publication date was 2110. She closed the book and put it down, swallowing hard. "Well?" Lanier asked softly. She looked up at him, frowning. Then a kind of understanding passed between them. She opened her mouth to speak and shut it again. "You've wondered why I'm so tired-looking," Lanier said.
"Yes."
"Do you understand now?"
"Because of this library?"
"Partly," he said.
"It's from the future. The stone is from our future."
"We're not certain of that," he said.
"But that's why I'm here, to help you figure out how."
"There are other puzzles, equally mystifying, and perhaps they all tie together." She opened the book again.
"Published by Greater Georgia General, in cooperation with Harpers of the Pacific."
He reached down and took the book from her hands. "That's enough for now. We'll go outside. You can rest for a bit, or we can spend a couple of hours at the security base."
"No," she said. "I want to go on."
She closed her eyes for a few seconds. He left to reshelve the book, then returned and walked ahead of her to the ground floor. "The subway entrance is 2 blocks from here," he said. "We can walk it. Exercise clears the head." She followed him across one corner of the park, looking at without really seeing the buildings and their signs in the various languages of Earth, knowing she was past the point of assimilation. They passed beneath a half-moon arch and walked down a double-back incline into the subway station.
"You said the stone wasn't from the future," Patricia commented.
"From our future," Lanier corrected. "It may not be from our universe."
Her skin felt warm. She blinked rapidly, not sure whether she was going to cry or laugh. Damn.
My sentiments exactly.
They stood on a broad platform near a wall ornamented with large, flat, rose-colored crystals arranged in irregular tessellations. Direction signs hung from the ceiling, letters scabbed and peeling. Nexus Central, Line 5. This side for Alexandria. San Juan Ortega, Line 6, 20 minutes. More of the ebony black flat display screens hung near the signs, all blank. Patricia felt a small tremor of dizziness. Was she really where she was, or suffering through a work-induced dream?
You're getting stoned, Linnea said. Watch yourself.
I am, yeah, watching myself getting stoned.
Depression is usually the next step. Disorientation, fantasies, depression. That's what I went through.
Oh?
She looked down at the white tiles beneath her feet. Should be a train coming in the next 5-10 minutes, Linnea said. He put his hands in his pockets and joined her in regarding the floor.
I'm doing fine, Patricia said.
She didn't believe herself, but on the other hand, she had felt worse before exams than she did now. She'd hold up. She had to.
I'm just wondering if there are better ways to indoctrinate newcomers. This seems pretty haphazard.
We tried other ways.
Didn't work?
No better. Some worse. A puff of air advanced out of the train tunnel. Patricia thought to peer over the edge of the platform to see what kind of mechanism the subway cars rode on. The floor of the channel was featureless, no rails or guides of any sort. Out of the tunnel hissed a giant aluminum millipede, its nose windowless and crossed by a radiance of green lines. It stopped with neck-jarring suddenness and hummed softly as its doors slid open. A marine guard stood in the lead car, holstered pistol and laser rifle prominent.
Mr. Lanier, he greeted, saluting smartly.
Charlie, this is Patricia Vasquez. Another green badge. Patricia, this is Corporal Charles Wirtz. You'll probably be seeing a lot of each other. Charlie is our main man on the zero train line.
Keep all the boojums from bumming a lift, Charlie said, grinning and shaking Patricia's hand.
Lanier beckoned for her to enter first. The interior, examined for basics, was like any reasonably new rapid transit system vehicle. The plastic seats and metal fixtures were in good repair. The cars had obviously not been designed for crowding, no hand straps or rails for standing passengers, and the arrangements were spacious, with lots of legroom, and no advertising. Indeed, within the car there were no signs at all.
Like an old BART in San Francisco, Patricia said.
She hadn't ridden on the BART or the L.A. Metro in years.
They settled back in their seats. There was no sensation of motion until she looked out the large round windows spaced at irregular intervals along the sides of the car. The station was a passing blur. Then there was only darkness relieved by flashing white vertical bars.
It just doesn't look that much like the future, she said. It's recognizable. I always thought the future would be so different. It wouldn't be recognizable. Particularly 1,000 years in the future. But there are buildings, subways. I mean, why no matter transmitters?
Alexandria and this rail system are a lot older than other parts of the stone. When you get around and see things in more detail, you'll notice big differences between our technology and this. Besides, he paused, there's history to consider. Delays, handicaps, and holdovers.
Which I'll know about soon enough.
Right, Lanier said.
Did you feel any motion just now? Acceleration?
She frowned.
No, but maybe we started out slowly.
The trains accelerated 4 G's.
Wait.
She turned to a window and looked at the passing bars of white, then frowned.
Alexandria. I mean, it wasn't designed right.
Lanier regarded her patiently. She was supposed to be brilliant, but in many ways she was so young, struggling to maintain her decorum as if she were a schoolgirl.
The stone has to accelerate and decelerate, right? Just like this train. But I don't feel any motion now, and the chambers should have angled floors to compensate for the thrust, for the wash of water in the lakes and ponds, higher walls on one side, acceleration slosh, angled walkways to compensate. There aren't any provisions for acceleration in the chambers, Lanier said.
So they accelerated slowly?
He shook his head.
They had some way to compensate?
The sixth chamber, Lanier said. But that's part of the big picture, too.
You're making me sort everything out for myself.
Whenever possible.
As a test?
No, Lanier said emphatically. The advisor said you can help us. I don't doubt that. But if this were a test, you'd be doing just fine. Though he had reservations. The tunnel walls passed behind them, and the train rushed into light. They passed over water, doing at least 200 or 300 kilometers an hour. In the elevated stretches, there are three rails under the cars. Magnetic induction, Lanier said.
Oh.
She turned her attention to the sea, a uniform expanse of rippling blue-gray, stretching north to a bank of fog against the cap. Above the gray expanse, she could see the chamber's arch, and to the northwest and northeast, the distant edges of the fog bank, and a shoreline at 3 o'clock high. About 7 kilometers from the train, its lower extremity hidden in white mist, was the hexagonal top of an upright tower, perhaps 50 meters tall and half as broad. Another tower appeared only a kilometer or so distant, fully visible and mounted on a slender round pylon. The fog rushed up to meet them, and suddenly they were over land. Rich pine forest blurred beneath, appearing healthy, if slightly blue, in the tube light. Fourth chamber was a recreation center, as near as we can tell, Lanier said, and of course a reservoir and air purification system. There are four distinct islands here, each with a different habitat. There were underwater habitats, too, coral gardens, freshwater ponds and river systems, resort, wildlife preserve, fish farm. It's all returned to an untended state, a bit wild, but prospering. The train slowed and slid with a faint humming noise over an elevated platform. Two men in black jumpsuits ran next to the cars as they came to a stop. Lanier stood, and she followed him to the door. It opened as silently as before. Forest, water, dirt, all in one glorious sniff. Later, Charlie, Lanier said. Charlie saluted smartly and took a stance in the doorway behind them. A platform guard stepped up to examine Patricia's badge. Welcome to summer camp, Miss Vasquez, he said. She looked down from the platform railing. They were 6 meters above the ground. The platform was surrounded by a compound, much like the one in the first chamber, with fiberboard buildings and earthen ramparts, but a much larger greenhouse agriculture laboratory. Everyone in the compound wore black, in combinations of black and khaki, black and green, and one black and gray. Security forces, she asked. Lanier nodded as they descended the platform stairs. We keep a small science group here, and we let people take their vacations or liberty here, when there's time for such things, which isn't often. This chamber is strategic. It divides the relatively livable parts of the stone from the business end.
The propulsion system?
That and the seventh chamber. Anyway, you'll have a chance to stretch your legs, assimilate what you've seen so far.
I doubt it, Patricia said.
Lanier guided her to the compound cafeteria. In most respects, the cafeteria was little different from the one in the first chamber. They sat at a table with British and West German soldiers. Lanier introduced her to the German commanding officer, Colonel Heinrich Berenson. He'll assume command of the 7th Chamber Security Forces a week from now. You'll be working together quite a bit. Berenson was a colonel in the West German Space Force, sandy-haired and freckle-faced, as tall as Lanier, but more obviously muscular. He appeared more Irish than German. With his non-German name and sophisticated manner, he seemed truly international to Patricia. His manner was friendly, but slightly distant. She ordered a salad, fresh greens from the Agri-Lab, and looked at the faces of the men and women around her. Not all of them had green badges.
How does the badge system work? She asked Lanier.
Berenson smiled and shook his head as if this was a sore point. Red badges are confined to the borehole in the first chamber, Lanier said. Mostly engineering support. Blue can go anywhere in the stone except the 6th and 7th chambers, but in all chambers but the first must be escorted and must be performing specific duties. Green badges can go to any of the chambers, but are always subject to security checks. I am here more than 3 years, Berenson said, and I only get a green 3 months ago. He glanced down at her badge and nodded meaningfully. Fortunately, I found a loophole. I can be considered to have escorted myself. Lanier grinned. Let's just be thankful things are going as smoothly as they have been. Amen, Berenson said. I would hate to see true confusion. For green badges, there are 3 levels of clearance. Level 1 is lowest. No access to designated secret areas. Level 2 is limited access for duty purposes. The special security guards have level 2 green badges. Level 3 is the clearance we share. I will be level 2, Berenson said. As they returned to the train, Patricia asked, Being level 2 means he won't know exactly what the stone is. When you get to the 7th chamber, you have to know a lot.
But not about what's in the libraries.
No, Lanier said. That sobered her. Berenson was morose, and he didn't even know about the libraries. The 4 space-suited soldiers ran in long, graceful leaps across the lunar surface, with only the stars and a quarter Earth to light their way. Mirsky watched them from the top of a boulder, only his white helmet showing. In his right hand, he held an electric torch, pointed back toward his team comrades, waiting in a gully carved by a rolling rock millions of years before. When the 4 were in the proper position, he flashed the light on and off 3 times. The objective, a mock-up of a lunar settlement bunker, lay 100 meters beyond the boulder. The 4 defenders were now by the airlock. Mirsky raised his AKV-297, automatic vacuum-adapted Kalashnikov projectile rifle, and pointed it at the airlock hatch. The hatch opened, and Mirsky raised the rifle slightly, centering it on a cross-barred target near the hatchway signal lights. With 1 gloved finger, he depressed the side-mounted trigger and felt the rifle kick 3 times. A thin line of burning gunpowder discharge from the barrel glowed briefly in the darkness. The target blew out in tatters of plastic as the door opened. Mirsky heard the exercise supervisor read off the numbers of the 4 space-suited defenders and order them to assume a reclining posture. Your airlock is also incapacitated, the supervisor added laconically. Fine work, Lieutenant Colonel. You may proceed. Mirsky and his 3 comrades advanced toward the mock-up. The defenders lay on the lunar soil outside the open hatchway, motionless except for the advancing numbers of their backpack life support displays. Mirsky leaned over and winked at one of them through his visor. The defender glared back at him, not in the least amused. Look over your shoulder at 2 o'clock, Comrade Lieutenant Colonel, one of his men advised. Mirsky turned around and followed the line of the corporal's thickly protected arm and gloved finger. The potato, a sharp point of light with a clearly discernible oblong shape, had just risen above the moon's horizon. It seemed that all his life people had been pointing it out to him. Efremova, 3 years before, the first among them. Yes, I see, Mirsky acknowledged. That is why we train, is it not, Comrade Lieutenant Colonel? Mirsky didn't answer. The supervisor cut in and demanded they stop the useless chatter. The stars have ears, Corporal, Mirsky advised the soldier. Let's take our objective and get home in time for more political lessons. The corporal met Mirsky's glance and grimaced but said nothing more. In their own bunker, 4 hours later, the exercise supervisor walked down the aisle between the sleeping swings of the victorious team, shaking hands and congratulating them warmly, and then handing out letters from home. All the men received letters, if only from party cell coordinators in some outlying village. The supervisor stopped by Mirsky's sling last. Only 1 letter for you, Comrade Colonel, he said, handing Mirsky a thick and carefully sealed and taped envelope. Mirsky took the envelope and stared at it, then at the supervisor. Open it. He carefully tore off the end and took out 5 folded sheets of paper. A promotion, he said, unwilling to be very emotional about the whole thing. And your orders, comrade, the supervisor said. Gentlemen, are we interested in discovering where our new Colonel Pavel Mirsky is going? Where? Several asked. Back to Earth, Nyuski said.
Back to Earth, the supervisor echoed. That is what? Your fourth training tour on the moon in 2 years?
And now back to Earth. The men watched him carefully, grinning.
To the Indian Ocean, Nyuski said, for final training as battalion commander.
To the Indian Ocean, the supervisor shouted, pointing one finger at the floor, symbolically indicating the Earth, and then raising both his hands, looking upward and nodding at the ceiling.
The men cheered and broke into applause.
Now you will have the stars you have always wanted, Colonel, the supervisor said, shaking his hand firmly.
Chapter 4. The rest of the fourth chamber slipped by the train windows quickly, a blur of hilly terrain, small lakes and outcroppings of what looked like granite. The line ends at the sixth chamber. We'll be met by Joseph Rimskaya and some of the Chinese team at the terminal annex.
Rimskaya? I had a teacher with that name at UCLA.
Rimskaya is why you're here. He recommended you.
But he left the university to join the Bureau of Math and Statistics.
And he met the advisor while working in Washington, Lanier added.
Rimskaya had been her professor in a special math seminar. She hadn't liked him much. He was a tall, blocky man with a wiry red beard, loud and assertive, a political science professor and expert in statistics and information theory. A rigorous mathematician, but not, in her opinion, in possession of the insight necessary for truly valuable research, Rimskaya had always seemed the perfect academician to her, rigid, demanding, and unimaginative taskmaster.
Why is he here?
Because the advisor finds him useful.
His specialty was statistical theories of population behavior. He belongs in sociology.
That's right, Lanier said.
How?
Lanier appeared irritated.
Think, Patricia. Where did the stoners go? Why did they go there? How did they get there?
I don't know, she answered quietly.
We don't know either. Not yet. Rimskaya is head of the sociology group. They might be able to tell us.
This is such an ass-backwards way of teaching.
I'll be patient if you will, Lanier said. Patricia was silent for a moment.
No guarantees, she said. I wish you'd stop seeming so peeved at me when I just ask straightforward questions.
Lanier raised his eyebrows and nodded. Please don't take it personally.
So he's under strain, she thought. Well, so am I. Only he's had time to get used to it, if you can ever get used to something like the library, or the stone itself. Then again, there's almost certainly more.
She had the sudden vision of a maze of chalkboards waiting for her in the seventh chamber, filled with wandering mathematicians working on some grand, unified problem. Over them all, on a huge video screen, the advisor watched patiently, like God. Lanier was her avatar.
Rimskaya is half-Russian, Lanier continued. His grandmother was a widow and an immigrant, and her name was applied on the U.S. entry papers to her son as well. He speaks Russian like a native. Sometimes he acts as interpreter between the Russians and us.
The train's hum increased in pitch, and they plunged into the fourth chamber's northern cap. The fifth chamber was darker than the previous sections she had visited. A canopy of flat gray clouds painted the cylinder's upper atmosphere, cutting out half the tube light. Beneath the clouds was a Wagnerian landscape of barren mountains, resembling ragged lumps of anthracite mixed with dark rainbowed hematite. Between the mountains were rusty abyssal valleys, cut by waterfalls feeding into quicksilver rivers. The mountains toward the middle of the chamber floor were startling in their contortions. Arches, giant rugged cubes, broken-tipped pyramids, and causeways of irregular slab steps.
What in hell was this? She asked.
A kind of open pit mine, we think. Our two geologists, you met Robert Smith, he's one, speculate that when the chambers were hollowed out, the fifth wasn't finished off. They left it for raw material, and the stoners used it. These are the scars.
Perfect for fans of old horror movies, Patricia said. Can't you just see Castle Dracula here?
They said nothing throughout the short trip down the next tunnel into the sixth chamber. As the train's hum decreased in pitch and the tunnel dark brightened,
Lanier stood and said, "End of the line." The lower terminal was a cavernous construct of unpainted slabs of reddish concrete and mottled gray and black asteroid rock. The platform was marked with faint lines, as though long winding queues had once formed there. "This was a workers' station once," Lanier said. "When they modified the sixth chamber, this served as a debarkation point, 600 years ago, perhaps."
"How long has the stone been deserted?"
5 centuries. They walked up a ramp into a building constructed mostly of thick, transparent panels, giving an excellent view of the sixth chamber. The valley floor was layered with gigantic, inert mechanical forms, cylinders and cubes and stacks of circular plates laid on edge, resembling a monstrous circuit board. Just outside the terminal building, a row of spherical tanks marched off to a distant wall. The wall was at least 100 meters high, and the tanks half that in diameter. Below this level of the terminal, between the spheres and a parallel row of cylinders resting on their sides, was an immense gully filled with glistening water. The channel was lined with pipe ends and cyclopean pumping apparatus. Over it all, thick black clouds floated in clumps, dropping curtains of rain and flurries of snow. Somewhere was a constant pulsing, less heard than felt, like the infrasound beats of moving mountains or the grinding of distant sea bottoms. Looking up at an angle, between decks of clouds, she could dimly see the opposite floor of the chamber, bumped and ridged with a carpet of mysterious mechanism. "No moving parts in the whole chamber except for large pumps, and not many of those," Lanier said. "The builders relied upon a built-in weather cycle. Rain falls, picks up heat, flows down channels into shallow ponds, evaporates, carries heat up, and the atmospheric maintenance systems drain it off. We're still not sure how."
"What does it all do?"
"When the stone was first designed, the sixth chamber was going to be another city, but the builders had specified that the stone could only accelerate at 3% G. Just before the stone was outfitted, and before the completion of the major excavation, they found a way to allow the stone to accelerate to the limit of its power. The method was complex and expensive, but it gave the stone a versatility the builders couldn't pass up. So the sixth chamber was equipped with selective inertial damping machinery, which makes up a small fraction of what is here now." He nodded at the vista through the glass. "That's why none of the chamber floors are inclined, and none of the ponds or rivers are equipped with slop barriers. They don't need them. The sixth chamber can selectively damp the effects of inertia on any object in the stone. On a large scale, it overcomes acceleration and deceleration of the entire ship. On a small scale, it prevents inertial effects in the trains. It's self-regulating, though we haven't found any brain yet." The rain hit the transparent roof and ran down the 45-degree slope over the stairwell. Lanier paused to look at the beads and rivulets of water. "Since that time, the machinery has been modified and expanded. It once covered about 3 square kilometers, and the rest of the sixth chamber was used for industry and research, things that couldn't be done in the cities. Now it maintains the seventh chamber as well." 4 people, all clad in yellow rain gear, marched along the edge of the channel beyond the terminal. They had parked their truck a few meters away on a raised roadbed. "Our reception committee," Lanier said. They walked to the head of the staircase. Cold air pooled in the stairwell, and Patricia shivered as an outside gust blew some of it over them. Rain sang softly overhead. Between the rivulets on the glass, through a trench-like break in the clouds, Patricia saw the opposite northern cap. All the other caps had been virtually blank, featureless. This one was furrowed by a row of rectangular boxes, spaced at equal intervals like a steep flight of stairs. On the face of each box was an elliptical design. The boxes, she estimated, were at least 1 kilometer wide, and the ellipses half that along their major axis. The first of the 4 to reach the top of the stairs doffed his rain cap. Patricia looked down to see her former professor, his face ruddy and bearded, eyes small and suspicious as if from some long-harbored hurt. Rimskaya was just as she remembered him. He returned her stare defensively, then nodded to Lanier. Behind him, a tall, even-featured blonde woman and 2 Chinese, a man and a woman wearing green caps, removed their gear and shook water off onto the floor. Rimskaya approached Patricia, his every gesture conveying aloofness, if not disgust. "Miss Vasquez," he said, "I hope you are up to this. I hope you do not make me seem like a fool for choosing you." She opened and shut her mouth like a carp, then laughed too loudly. "Professor, I hope so, too." "Don't mind him," said the blonde woman, her voice pleasant and deep, with a faint British accent. "He said nothing but good about you for 4 months now." She clutched her own cap under her arm and held out her hand. Patricia shook it. Her grip was firm and warm. "I'm Karen Farley. This is Wu Gime and Zhang Yixing." Zhang smiled broadly at Patricia, her straight black bangs hanging down over her eyebrows, the latest Chinese fashion. "We're from Beijing Technological University." Rimskaya still studied Patricia. His gray eyes narrowed. "You are healthy? No space sickness? No emotional distress?"
"I'm fine, Professor," she said.
"Good. Then you," he indicated Farley, Wu, and Zhang, "you take care of her. I'm going to the first chamber to rest. I'll be gone a week, perhaps longer." He held his hand out to Lanier, and they shook once, firmly. "I am tired," Rimskaya said, "not least because I have no idea what this all signifies. I have never been an imaginative man, and this place..." He shuddered. "Perhaps it will suit you better, Miss Vasquez." He bowed stiffly to his colleagues, then picked up his gear and walked toward the ramp leading to the train platform. Patricia looked after him, nonplussed. "I envy him, a bit," said Wu, in perfect California English. He was about her height, just on the edge of plumpness, with a stiff crew cut and a childlike face. "I have read some of your papers recently, Miss Vasquez."
"Patricia, please."
"They are quite beyond me, I'm afraid. Zhang and I are electrical engineers. Karen is a physicist."
"Theoretical physics. I've been very impatient to meet you," Farley said.
"Impatient," Lanier corrected.
"Yes."
Farley grinned at Patricia's puzzlement.
"I'm a Chinese citizen also. I can fool most people most of the time. Correct me, please, when I blunder."
Patricia looked between them owlishly. She felt a bit strung out, not yet ready to meet new people and stretch her sociability. "We're escorting Patricia to the seventh chamber," Lanier said, "but she may want to rest here a while."
"No," Patricia shook her head firmly. "I'm going for the big picture today."
"That's a woman," Farley said. "Suicidal doggedness, something I admire. Zhang has it. Gime, we call him Lucky. Gimur's a lazy fellow, though."
"Both she and Professor Rimskaya are slave drivers," Zhang said.
Her English accent was markedly less proficient than Wu's and Farley's. She produced two packets of rain gear from a pouch in her own coat and gave them to Lanier and Patricia. They suited up quickly and left the shelter of the annex. The air smelled of clean rain, ozone, and metal. The rain had slowed to a drizzle, and the snow had stopped. Water slid in sheets from sloping metal walls below the elevated road, collecting in gutters and washing to a catch basin meters below. Patricia peered into the basin and saw the smooth funnel of water descending into darkness. The truck on the roadbed was a replica of the vehicle which had taken them across the first chamber. Farley offered Patricia the shotgun seat again, and the others climbed into the back, pushing aside boxes of fabric-wrapped scientific gear. Farley edged the truck forward, then brought it up to speed. The roadbed expanded into a broad, flat ribbon, winding through complexes of tanks and gray shapes hidden behind a rapidly spreading fog. Wu leaned between the two seats. "This stuff that looks like asphalt, it isn't. It's asteroid rock. All the metals removed, ground up and mixed with a plant-based oil. Very tough, no cracks. We wonder who's going to patent it." Somehow Patricia found the dreariness invigorating. There was a bluish quality about the fog that made her feel as if she were within a sapphire. The rain resumed, and the drum of water on the truck's roof, combined with a gentle surge of warm air from the heater, made everything seem secure, no more strenuous than watching an entertainment on a video. She snapped herself out of that feeling quickly. Lanier was watching her. She angled her face toward him and then looked away.
How could they consider her so important? In the face of this monumental mystery, what could she possibly do? The size alone was enough to paralyze thought. Looking up through gaps in the cloud cover to the opposite side, she could just as well have been looking from the window of a shuttle re-entering the atmosphere. The truck followed the gently curving highway and crossed the sixth chamber in 20 minutes. The familiar arch and tunnel entrance loomed ahead. Farley switched on the lights as the tunnel enveloped them. After the stormy sixth chamber, the clarity and brightness of the unhindered plasma tube light was welcome. "You can almost hear the birds singing," Patricia commented. "I wish," Farley said. They descended the ramp. Ahead stretched an arrow straight road, about half as broad as the sixth chamber highway, and made of the same material. To each side of the road, sandy hummocks topped with stiff yellow grass dotted the floor for several kilometers. A short hike away were strands of low, scrawny trees. To the west, up the curve of the chamber floor, Patricia saw small lakes and what looked like a river emerging from one of the capped tunnels. A few fleecy clouds clung to the cap. The landscape was equally homogeneous and bland, right up to the limits of the tube light, both east and west. The plasma tube itself emerged from the center of the cap in a straight, unobscured beacon. Patricia could feel the anticipation building in the cabin, centering on her. They were waiting for her reaction. Reaction to what? If anything, this chamber was less impressive than the first. Her shoulders tensed. So what was she supposed to say? Lanier reached between the seats to touch her arm. "What do you see?" he asked. "Sand, grass, lakes, trees, a river, some clouds." "Look straight ahead." She looked. The air was clear. Visibility was at least 30 kilometers. The northern cap seemed to be obscured, not nearly as obvious as the looming gray presence in the other chambers. She looked up and squinted, trying to make out the end of the plasma tube. It didn't end. It went on, certainly more than 30 kilometers, getting dimmer and thinner until it almost merged with the horizon. Of course, on a non-curved surface, as the cylinders were viewed parallel to the axis, the horizon was much higher. Given unlimited distance, the horizon would begin at a true vanishing point in the perspective. "This chamber's longer," she said. "Yes," Wu agreed cautiously. Zhang nodded, grinning as if at some joke, her hands folded demurely in her lap. "Now let me get this straight. We've traveled about 220 kilometers into the stone, which is about 290 kilometers long, so this chamber could be maybe 50 kilometers across." Her hands were trembling. "But it isn't."
"Look closely," Lanier said.
"It's an optical illusion. I can't see the northern cap." "No," Farley said, all too sympathetic. "So?" Patricia looked around the cab. The others kept their faces impassive, except for Zhang's secretive smile. "What the hell am I supposed to see?"
"You tell us," Lanier said.
She figured furiously in her head, looking up at the opposite side of the chamber, trying to calculate distances in the strange perspective of the huge cylinders. "Stop the truck." Farley brought the vehicle to a halt, and Patricia descended from the cab to stand on the roadway. Then she clambered up a ladder to a platform on top of the cab and looked down the straight line of the road. The road went to its own vanishing point. No cap, no barrier. Above, the rest of the landscape did much the same. "It's bigger," she said. Farley and Lanier stood by the truck, looking up at her. Wu and Zhang joined them. "It's bigger than the asteroid. It goes beyond the end. Is that what you're trying to tell me?"
"We don't tell," Lanier said. "We show. It's the only way."
"You're trying to tell me it doesn't stop? It goes right on out the other end?"
She heard the touch of panic and high-pitched fascination in her own voice. The Stanford professor, 6 years before, had been wrong. Someone besides extraterrestrials and gods could appreciate her work.
She now knew why she had been brought up from Vandenberg, carried to the stone by shuttle and OTV. The asteroid was longer on the inside than it was on the outside. The seventh chamber went on forever. Chapter 5. Patricia had slept. She checked her watch. 9 hours. She lay on the cot, listening to the gentle sound of tent canvas clapping in the breeze. In at least this region of the seventh chamber, there was little need for solid-walled buildings. The weather was dry and mild, the air temperature warm. She stared up at the awning stretched between aluminum poles, at the smoky outline of the plasma tube through the cloth. "I am here. This is real." "You bet your life," she whispered. Inside the tent, a complex of partitions and tarp floors covering about 100 square meters, Farley and Zhang were speaking Chinese in muted tones. The first few hours in the chamber, while they had arranged a cubicle in the tent for her and prepared for a cookout, Patricia had been hyperactive, darting about like a moth, asking questions that sometimes made little sense. Lanier had watched her glumly for a while. She had felt she was somehow disappointing him. But later he had joined the others in laughing at her, with her, and had produced a surprise bottle of champagne. "To christen your new self," he had said. On the first round, they had tried to find something more fitting in the way of names for what everyone had heretofore referred to simply as the seventh chamber or the corridor. "Spaghetti world," Farley had suggested. "No," Wu countered, "more like macaroni world, hollow in the middle." Zhang tossed in pipe world. Tube and tunnel had already been appropriated for other parts of the stone. The words and shapes seemed to echo against each other, a sexually charged confusion of fittings within fittings. A couple of glasses of champagne, and Patricia had become desperately drowsy. They had barely set up a cot under the awning before she was sound asleep. She stretched and propped her head on her elbow, looking across the scrub and sand, and up at the enormous cylinder of land stretching into the haze. Farley came out of the tent and sat beside the cot.
"Dreaming?" "No," Patricia said. "Musing. When Gary gave us the grand tour 1.5 years ago, I thought I'd go crazy. What's your opinion of the indoctrination? I mean, it's really just beginning for you, but..." She trailed off, regarding Patricia with very blue eyes. Farley was perhaps 10 years older than she, and there was humor evident in the lines around her lips and eyes. She had a demanding directness in her manner. Almost a female version of Lanier, Patricia thought.
"Seeing is not quite believing," she answered. "So just hearing about it certainly wouldn't be enough."
"After a while, we tend to become complacent," Farley said, staring down the gray-green road. "It worries me sometimes. When new people arrive and see what we see every day, we are shaken back into realizing how strange it really is. Sometimes I feel like a beetle crawling through a fusion power plant. I can feel a certain amount, see a certain amount, but I sure as hell don't understand everything." She sighed. "I'm not sure Gary approves, but I think you should be warned about the Boojums."
"He mentioned them. What are they?"
"Some of us have seen Boojums. Spooks. I haven't, and none of our group have. The consensus is they're psychological, a sign of the strain. There haven't been any really clear sightings, photographs or anything, so be wary of what you see. And be doubly wary. No one has proven that the stone or the corridor is completely deserted. We're just too few to adequately explore and police all the chambers. So if you see anything, report it, but don't believe it." She smiled. "Does that make sense?"
"No," Patricia said, swinging her legs over the side of the cot. "Do I have a work schedule, some idea of what I'm supposed to be doing when?"
"Gary will tell you all about that in 1/2 hour or so. He's sleeping now. Exhausted. We're all a bit worried about him, you know."
"You and the others, you have green badges, but do you have third-level clearance?"
"Heavens, no." Farley laughed, tossing her long blonde hair back over her shoulders. "We're Chinese. We're lucky to have gotten this far.
We're here by courtesy, and because our governments happen to be friendly this decade. All the same, we're much better off than the poor Russians. They get to study the boreholes and the plasma tubes and very little else. Everyone perceives plasma physics to be their specialty, so they're stuck on the axis. Americans have no conception what fine archaeologists they have. Now, as for their sociology... She shook her head ruefully. I'm a born and bred Marxist, but I'm not sure the Stoners would fit strict Leninist dogma. Gary hasn't given me any details on the agreements. I read about them at home, but I know we weren't told everything. NATO Eurospace vessels were the first to reach the stone and begin exploration. By the ISCCOM agreements, NATO has the right to control exploitation, and NATO is dominated by the United States, of course. The Russians have protested this is a special case, but they haven't gotten anywhere so far. The Chinese have never been terribly interested in deep space, so we've accepted what little we've been allowed. By being quiet and subservient, we've come much further than the Russians. No Russians in the seventh chamber, you'll notice.
You don't sound Chinese.
Farley laughed.
Thank you. Everyone says my accent is good, but sometimes my words... Well, what you're really saying, I think, is I don't look Chinese. I'm a second-generation Caucasian immigrant. My parents were British expatriates in Czechoslovakia. They were agricultural specialists, and China welcomed them with open arms when they emigrated in 1978. I was born there.
I've spent all of my life in California, Patricia said. I feel so protected compared to you, out of touch with the real world.
The world of intrigue and international politics?
Me too. I spent most of my life on a farm in Hopi, rather cut off, and now we're both here. She looked down at the ground, shaking her head.
For various reasons, there are a lot of things we shouldn't talk about. Gary trusts me, and I respect his trust. We've all done our best to be courteous and trustworthy. That's why we've come this far.
So, technical matters directly relating to our work, that's okay. But anything having to do with subjects off-limits to Wu, Zhang, and me, no discussion. None at all.
Okay, Patricia said.
Farley looked north, directly down the throat of the corridor.
The Stoners made this. They were humans, just like you and me. Beyond that, we're encaved in the dark. But sometime, we will run into them, or something even stranger.
She smiled thinly.
Is that a prediction strong enough for you?
Patricia nodded.
Anything more specific, I'll get the shakes.
Farley patted her on the shoulder.
Must get back. Gary will be with you shortly.
She entered the tent. Patricia stood and smoothed down her jumper, then walked a few dozen meters across the sand. She bent down and ran her hand through the blades of a clump of grass. The length of the corridor was so startling, compelling, that her breath slowed. It was spare, economical, incredibly beautiful. The even lighting, the gradually receding but nevertheless clear details, the sand, the bushes, the lakes and rivers flowing from southern cap condensation. Despite what Farley had said, Patricia felt safe walking another dozen or so meters west. And having gone that far, still within a few minutes' run of the tent, it seemed no big deal to go an equal distance beyond. She reached the edge of the dwarf forest in 10 minutes, then glanced back to orient herself to the tent and the ramp emerging from the cap tunnel. The trees resembled scrubby pines, none more than 2 meters tall, their gnarled branches intertwined into an impenetrable thicket. She had never seen anything precisely like them on Earth, but their needles were similar to those on the Douglas fir Christmas trees her family used to buy before settling on an aluminum substitute. She bent down to peer under the low canopy, but saw no sign of life. How strange that the Stoners should take every living, moving thing with them, stripping the stone. Where did they all go? That much was obvious now. She could feel the compulsion each time she looked down the corridor. They headed into the infinite north, if the corridor truly was infinite.
Patricia, Lanier called from the tent. She jumped, slightly guilty, but there was no urgency or rebuke in his voice.
Yes?
Work to do, On my way.
She returned to the tent. They sat by a folding table arranged under the awning. Lanier took a slate and plugged in a memory block, then set the apparatus between them. You should have some idea now why we need you here. We have a couple of mysteries to figure out, and that, he pointed down the corridor, may not be the greater.
I wouldn't think so, she said.
I've already programmed a first draft schedule for you. You'll get a tour of the Third Chamber City, concentrating on a library there. That city was called Thistledown, just like the stone itself. It's a couple of centuries newer than Alexandria. And you'll make several return visits to the library in the second chamber. That'll take a week or two, just getting you started. He pointed to the slate and tapped a run button. Instructions scrolled down the screen. Here's how to use the subways, schedules and precautions. Obviously, I won't be able to guide you all the time, or even very often. Work piling up all over. And I'll probably be returning to Earth for a short while. During that time, you'll report to Carrollson. Most of the facts you need to know regarding security are in that block. Who to talk to, who not, protocol, that sort of thing. Farley, Wu, and Zhang are fine people, but be circumspect. Be circumspect around anyone who doesn't have the same privileges you do.
Who else can I talk to besides you?
Carrollson. You can talk to her about everything but what you read in the libraries. I'm working to get her clearance for that, too, but not yet. You'll meet others in a couple of days. Some will have library clearance, and you'll be working with them, coordinating, cross-checking. Clear enough? For the next couple of weeks, it's going to be study, study, study.
How far from the camp can I go?
As far as you can walk, but take along a radio. We have a security base about 50 kilometers down the corridor, with sensors set to pick up any activity in the corridor for several hundred kilometers. If they call a retreat, get back to the tunnel as soon as possible.
What's the likelihood of that happening?
Small, Lanier shrugged. Maybe non-existent. Hasn't happened yet. I hope you don't resent kid glove treatment. If anything happened to you, the advisor would have new hairless rugs all over her floor. Patricia grinned. So who's my duenna? Until Carrollson gets here, Farley. Questions?
Let me get started, then I'll ask questions.
Fair enough. Lanier left her at the table. She picked up the slate and began the first memory block. Chapter 6. Lanier left on the next shift, saying he would be back in 2 days to begin the next part of her education. Carrollson arrived a few hours later, carrying a box of memory blocks and a more powerful processor recently shipped from Earth. At least I can take part of my work with me wherever I go, she said. Farley, Wu, and Zhang immediately began submitting some of their problems to the new processor. Patricia studied the cubes that contained information on the corridor. The length of the corridor was unknown, but radar signals sent from the borehole had not yet returned after the passage of 4 months. It was assumed that either the corridor had no end, or that the signals had been absorbed in some as yet unexplained way. Exploration teams had made several forays into the corridor, but until recently, none had proceeded farther than 500 kilometers. To that point, the corridor was indistinguishable from the seventh chamber it adjoined. A thick layer of dirt, atmosphere at stone normal pressure, 650 millibars, and the normal intensity of flux tube lighting. The corridor differed from the seventh chamber in one respect. 436 kilometers down the line, it was surrounded by a circuit of artificial structures, 4 motionless cupolas floating without support above wide dimples in the soil. Each of the 4 cupolas stood alone, spaced at equal distances from the others around the circumference. What they were made of was unknown, but the substance didn't match any of the characteristics of matter except for solidity. 872 kilometers down the line was another circuit, and a new expedition was exploring in that area now. Patricia tapped the slate's burnisher against her tooth, then reached into her personal effects bag and brought out the stereo attachment and a coin of Mozart. The attachment fitted easily in the standardized socket and played the magic flute as she read on, undisturbed. She cut the music and took a break after an hour and a half. Despite Carrollson's protestations that she wasn't Voskase's nursemaid, to Patricia that described her role exactly. She had no immediate duties in the seventh chamber, and her expertise wasn't complimentary to Patricia's. Still, there was a certain comfort in having the older woman around. She was relaxed, self-confident, and easy to get along with. A good person to ask questions of, if only to bounce thoughts around. The intricacies of stone protocol and organization were not easy to master. A chart in the memory block Lanier had left her with showed it all clearly. Under the supervision of the ISCCOM Regulatory Committee, NATO Eurospace, more directly NASA and the European Space Agency, were in charge of the stone's exploration. The Joint Space Command had a very large say in how the studies were conducted. Despite the civilian overgarments, this was largely a military operation. Judith Hoffman, nominally coordinating the civilian and military agencies from her offices in Sunnyvale and Pasadena, tempered this reality a little. The Stone security team consisted of some 300 Americans, about half, 150 British, and 100 Germans. The remaining 50 were from Canada, Australia, and Japan. France was not a member of NATO Eurospace and had declined an invitation to send its nationals to the Stone, no doubt partly in protest of NATO pressure to join in the major rearmament of the first 2 years of the 21st century. Through their respective commanders, the Stone security team took orders from U.S. Navy Captain Bertram D. Kirchner, Commander of External Security, and Army Brigadier General Oliver Gerhardt, in charge of internal security. The 600 team members worked throughout the Stone to defend the civilians in case of attack. Who might attack was unspecified, but in the beginning, obviously, attack was expected from the 7th Chamber, or from hidden elements in the unexplored 2nd and 3rd Chamber cities. Lanier acted as Hoffman's direct voice on the Stone. He coordinated science, engineering, and communication. Carlson was the senior science supervisor. Heinemann was in charge of civilian engineering, and a woman named Roberta Pickney, civilian communication. The structural breakdown of the science team was informative. There were mathematicians, archaeologists, physicists, social scientists, including historians, computer and information specialists, and medical biology experts. There were also four lawyers. Engineering consisted of support, with a military adjunct, and mechanics. Communication also had a military adjunct, in charge of coded transmission. Pickney, assisted by Sylvia Link, was responsible for internal Stone communications and Earth Space Station lunar settlement networks. Patricia thought she would never be able to remember even the most important names. Names had never been her strong suit. Faces and personalities she did better with. Besides the United States and Eurospace civilian personnel, representatives from Russia, India, China, Brazil, Japan, and Mexico had been invited to serve on the science team. Some Australians and one Laotian were to arrive soon. Carlson intimated there had been trouble with the Russians. They had only been on the Stone for a year after finally agreeing to certain restrictions. Despite their agreement, they had been demanding, reasonably enough, Patricia thought, access to all information on the Stone, including the libraries. The libraries, Carlson explained, were a purely American preserve, by direct order of Hoffman and the President. They'd save us all a hell of a lot of trouble if they just opened everything up to everybody, Carlson said. I despise secrecy. But she enforced her orders.
So who's handling the science team while you're here with me? Patricia asked.
Carlson smiled. I put Rimskaya on it. He's snarly but efficient, and people will certainly think twice before coming to him with complaints. Me, I'm just a pussycat. I need this kind of vacation. Lanier's memory block specified precisely whom she could talk to and whom not about her studies. If she wished to discuss the library, she could only speak with Rimskaya, Lanier, and one science team member she hadn't met yet, Rupert Takahashi. He was on the current corridor expedition. Patricia ate lunch with Carlson and the three Chinese, napped for half an hour, then took her slate and a camp stool across the flat to the dwarf forest, where she sat and began to make her own notes. Carlson joined her an hour later, carrying a thermos of iced tea and a couple of bananas.
I'll need some tools, Patricia said. A compass, a ruler, some pencils, or... I've been thinking.
Is it possible that one of the engineers or electronics people could make a tool for me?
Name it.
I'd like to know what the value of pi is in the corridor.
Carolson pursed her lips.
Why?
Well, so far as I've read, the corridor is definitely not made of matter. It's something else entirely. Last night, I mean last sleep, Farley and I talked, and she explained what she knew. This morning I peeked at some of the papers Rimskaya and Takahashi put together before my arrival.
Back in the amateur days of superspace mathematics, Carolson said wryly, Rimskaya probably should have stuck to his expertise.
Perhaps, but he made some interesting suggestions. Tomorrow, Karen is going to take me to the borehole.
She pointed up at the plasma tube and the southern cap axis.
If I can have a pi meter by that time, maybe I can learn some things.
Done, Carolson said. Anything else?
I don't know if it's even possible, but as long as we're measuring pi, I'd like to measure slash h and the gravitational constant, whatever else they can think of pertaining to the qualities of the universe. A kind of multimeter.
You think the constants will vary here?
Some of them, at least.
Slash H, the quantum of momentum?
We wouldn't even exist.
There could be a difference in ratio. I'd just like to know.
Carolson stood, picked up the empty thermos and the banana skins, and returned to the tent. Minutes later, she and Wu left in the truck, taking the tunnel back to the sixth chamber.
Patricia stared down the corridor, frowning slightly.
She had very real, if limited, power. She had just made a Nobel laureate jump to do her bidding.
For much of her life, Patricia had spent her most important moments in her head, lost in a world that would have been completely incomprehensible to the vast majority of people on Earth. Now, sitting by the dwarf forest, listening to the Mozart Jupiter Symphony, and staring down the length of the corridor, she felt at first nervous, then irritated that the state wasn't coming fast enough. She knew where to begin. If the corridor wasn't made of matter, there were only a few alternatives. Either it was a tube of restraining forces passing beyond the end of the asteroid through some superspace trickery, or it was not. If not, then it was likely to be constructed itself of superspace trickery. She considered and dismissed as philosophically useless, for the moment, the notion that the corridor was an illusion. Superspace trickery was the more difficult concept to work with. If the Stoners had used the machinery in the sixth chamber to distort space-time, there would be consequences. When the multimeter arrived, if it did what she had requested, she could begin laying down parameters. Curved space on the scale of the corridor would probably produce fluctuations in the value of pi, since the diameter of a circle, in any seriously distorted manifold, would vary in relation to its circumference. Other constants would vary depending on distortions in higher geometries. She gave up trying to force the state after a while. The facts weren't sufficient to warrant straining herself. There was nothing she could do for the moment but relax and read. She plugged another memory block into the slate. How long did it take you to get used to living without night? Patricia asked.
Farley tapped her fingers impatiently against the wall of the arch, waiting for the Axis elevator. They stood 50 meters east of the tunnel ramp, on a smooth polished square of nickel iron.
I'm not sure I am used to it, Farley said. I live with it, but I miss starry nights.
With all their technology, you'd think the Stoners would have come up with some way to have darkness.
Shutting off the plasma tube would be a huge waste of energy, Farley mused, especially for the seventh chamber. I mean, it does seem to go on forever, and how could you shut off something like that?
Patricia pulled out her slate and typed, Seventh chamber plasma tube. Power supply? Maintenance? Same as other chamber tubes? The elevator door opened and they entered the large circular cabin. The door closed as Farley pressed a button. They both grasped bars mounted in the walls. At first, the acceleration of the elevator increased their total weight, but as they rose, approaching the axis, the effects canceled out. The elevator reached a steady velocity after traveling about a third of the way up the shaft. Their weight had decreased considerably by then. Shortly after, they began to decelerate, slipping smoothly into near weightlessness. The door opened, and a guard in black and gray greeted them. The Axis compartments surrounding the seventh chamber borehole had been pressurized and heated, but otherwise they remained much as the Stoners had left them centuries before. Ribbons of newly wired lighting crisscrossed the cavernous staging area. "We're going to the Singularity Monitor," Farley said. The soldier gestured for them to board a cart. They followed the ropes and took their seats, buckling themselves in. "I have a feeling you're going to show me something else astonishing," Patricia said accusingly. "I'm not even used to the other wonders yet." "Ancillary wonder," Farley said mysteriously. "A result of the other wonders, if you follow Rimskaya and Takahashi's theories. But you're the space-time expert here." "I'm not so sure," Patricia said distantly. "If the corridor is a matrix of bent geodesics, a warped tube of space, what would you expect to find at its center?"
"I wondered about that yesterday afternoon."
She paused as the cart neared the end of the staging area. "It's not going to work down the center. There's going to be a region where all the rules fail."
"Precisely." "A singularity?"
"That's where we're going," Farley said. The guard pulled the cart alongside an airlock mounted in the rock wall. Farley gripped a guide bar and helped Patricia out of her belt. The guard saluted and said he would wait for them. They entered the airlock. Farley switched on a light and pulled down two rumply one-size-fits-all pressure suits from a rack. "You can snug the arm and leg length a bit with these straps. Mobility and finesse aren't really needed here, just pressure and temperature and air. This isn't the most visited spot on the stone." The rear wall of the airlock was equipped with a broad-runged ladder, ascending to a wheel-opened hatch in the ceiling. Bits and pieces of equipment, some obviously long abandoned, lay stacked in the corners and under the ladder. "Just watch your step. Take everything slowly. There's no danger if you're careful. If anything happens to your suit, very unlikely, we can be back in the lock in less than 2 minutes." Farley checked Patricia's suit seals and pressed a red button on a panel mounted near the ladder. The air was quietly pumped out of the chamber until Patricia could hear only her own breathing. End of side 2.